Chapter 7. Empty threats. False flags. The best at what I do.
I should throw you both in the brig,
snapped Cadmus Tyro, pacing the metalled floor of the embarkation deck. Wayland at least had the good grace to look guilty, but Nykona Sharokin managed to impart an unrepentant insouciance to his stance.
Him I can understand, said Tyro. But you, Sebik, what do you have to say for yourself?
I would say that Brother Sharokin's actions should be classed as due diligence, said Wayland.
What?
He was simply ensuring that what Captain Medjuson told us was true.
Tyro looked over at Shadrach Medjuson, who had brought the trespassing Raven Guard back aboard the Malleus Ferrum. The captain of the Sorgol clan was impassive, his scarred face giving nothing away as to his humours. Was he enraged at this impugning of his honesty, or might he see this as Wayland did?
You doubted the word of a fellow Ironhand,
didn't you? Countered Wayland. Just because you want to believe Captain Medjuson is our ally doesn't make it so.
Tyro expected an outburst from Medjuson at this insult to his honour, but the scarred warrior said nothing.
And did he find anything?
Demanded Tyro, not even bothering to address the question to Sharokin. Wayland glanced at the Raven Guard, who kept his eyes fixed forwards.
No,
said Wayland.
I should strip you of rank and position. Break you back down to the ranks.
I heard Ironhands didn't make empty threats, said Sharokin.
Tyro struggled to keep his temper. He'd faced down the worst horrors the galaxy had to throw at a man, but Sharokin didn't blink. The Raven Guard's ebon eyes stared back, and Tyro saw the mirror of his own unflinching nature.
What did you say?
You shouldn't make threats you're not going to carry out.
You think I won't?
Said Tyro.
I know you won't.
And why not?
You need me, said Sharokin. I'm the best at what I do, and you don't have anyone aboard like me.
I need someone who can't obey orders. I need a warrior who sets his own rules of engagement and conduct.
Yes, said Sharokin. That's exactly what you need.
He's right, Cadmus, said Shadrach Medjuson. And were our circumstances reversed, I'd have done the same.
So why didn't you? Asked Sharokin.
Medjuson grinned his burn-skewed grin.
Who says I haven't?
You think I wouldn't know?
Oh, so sure of yourself, little raven, said Medjuson,
closing the distance between him and Sharokin. Though there was little difference in their height, Medjuson somehow managed to tower over the Raven Guard.
You've spent a few years aboard an Iron Hands vessel, and you think you know all there is to know about us. You're good, Brother Sharokin. Very good. And the shadows bend to your will like no one I've seen before. But these are vessels of steel and stone, the twin flesh of Medusa. And none know that flesh better than the sons of Ferus Manus.
I'd have known, repeated Sharokin.
Really? Then how is it that Ashur Maesan was able to gain entry to your vessel and see your Kryptos beast for himself? Quite a setup you have down there, Wayland. Tell me, is it really necessary to bind the thing with fetters?
Not even Sharokin's inscrutable features could hide his shock at Medjuson's words. Tyro was just as shocked.
You put a man on my ship?
I did, said Medjuson. And while I regret such a gross breach of trust was necessary, we both know trust is in short supply in such times as we find ourselves.
Medjuson's words stoked Tyro's already well-banked anger, but this wasn't a discussion to be had before his crew. He shot a glance at Sharokin and Wayland, saying,
You're dismissed!
They turned to go, both vindicated and chastised.
Wayland,
said Tyro,
how long until the Kryptos finishes decrypting the Morgel's avionics log?
Any minute now, said Wayland.
Then get me a heading before next watch bell.
Wayland nodded, and he and Sharokin marched from the deck. Tyro didn't give them a second glance.
I'm not happy. You put a man on my ship,
he told Medjuson when they were gone.
I could say the same thing.
Sherokin acted without my authority.
You should have given him authority, said Medjuson. I'm just surprised it took him this long to board my ship. I think he waited out of respect for you, hoping you would give him that order. Does the Sisyphean's crew lack resolve, Cadmus?
Tyro was stung by the rebuke, just as much from the fact that it had been given, as he was in knowing it was entirely justified.
No, it does not, he said.
Good, said Mitchison. This coming fight will test us all, and only men of resolve will survive it.
You'll not find us wanting,
promised Tyro.
See that I don't.
15 days later, and 3 isolated star systems over, the Iron Heart and the Sisyphean drifted silently towards a world the astronavigation charts named Erin Septimus. A scaled orb of jade and umber, everything about it told Wayland that it was plunging towards a slow and inevitable doom. Its image sat in the center of the Sisyphean's main viewer, wreathed in banded layers of corrosive atmospherics. Inset at each corner of the screen was a slowly degrading pict from the servitor drones launched 30 minutes previously. Each revealed planetary topography that would soon be submerged beneath acidic oceans as torrential chemical rains spilled in an unending deluge from the impenetrable clouds.
A death world, if ever I saw one, said Shadrach Mitchison.
A holographic representation of the Ironheart's master stood at Cadmus Tyro's right hand, arms folded across his broad chest. Though Tyro sat in the captain's throne, the dynamic of who exactly was in command was hard to fix.
Deadlier than most, agreed Wayland. But it's those clouds that make Erin Septimus valuable.
Valuable to who?
Said Tyro, looking like he was imagining how it would be possible to fight within such a biosphere.
To anyone who knows its truth, said Wayland. Erin Septimus was entered into the Carta Imperialis by the 20th, yet the Estimere describes it as a dead world of no value.
Keeping it for themselves, sneered Medjuson,
his image wavering with static.
So how exactly is it valuable?
Asked Tyro.
The atmosphere is incredibly dense and seeded with crystalline deposits of promethium from some earlier epoch of geological upheaval.
Usable promethium?
Asked the Matica.
Only in the last decade, said Wayland,
as a fresh graph appeared on the screen.
Over millions of years, as the seventh planet's orbit carried it fractionally closer to the star, its atmosphere has now absorbed enough heat for those suspended promethium crystals to melt, hence the planetary deluge.
How would you harness that resource?
Asked Tyro.
Like this, said Wayland.
And the display changed to reveal an airborne colossus sitting at the very upper limits of the breathable atmosphere, like one of the great orbital plates of Terra. Its size was difficult to judge, but it resembled the industrial powerhouse of Rodinia and possessed the monumental scale of Valbara. The first metaphor the mind conjured was of a vast jellyfish, or flattened octopus, drifting serenely across a fiery ocean of blazing clouds. Its underside was hazed by immense repulsors, between which thousands of flexible siphon tentacles plunged deep into the promethium-rich soup below. The platform's upper surface was wreathed by an umbra of tar-black exhaust gases and lit by the hellish glare of flame-belching vent towers. Beneath this sullen shroud, its deck was encrusted with titanic refineries, thundering pump structures and vast silo towers. The spaces separating these structures were tangled lattices of iron spars, air processors, and thousands of kilometers of pipework that leaked toxic exhalations. Even through the sickly fog, it was possible to make out the hydra-headed icons atop the platform's many towers.
As best I can make out from its very few emissions, its designation is Learner 212, said Wayland.
Throne of Terror,
breathed Tyro, at the sight of this nightmarish vision of industrial madness.
It's an all but limitless supply of ship-grade promethium, and processing manufactories capable of refining engine-ready plasma, said Wayland. A coaling station, as such places were once known.
Messy, said Medjuson. Inefficient. Primarch Gilliman would not approve.
I saw a sizable Mechanicum presence, yes, said Tyro.
An estimated 1,000 priests and servitors, agreed Wayland. But most of the facility will be self-regulating. If it were ours, I'd set it to harvest enough promethium to fill the silos and then shut down, which would explain why no one has seen it before now. When it goes dark, it's next to invisible in the atmosphere.
Is that a ship? Said Medjuson,
bending to study his own vessel's surveyor input.
Good eyes, Captain Medjuson, said Wayland.
And moments later, another image appeared on the main viewer. A ripple of unease spread around the bridge as the clouds parted and the prow of a warship bearing the Hydra of the Alpha Legion became momentarily visible.
Yes, said Wayland. A rapid strike cruiser. Designation, as you'd expect, unknown. It's taking on fuel, and looks like it's being kept synchronous with Learner 212 by a number of very precise EMAG tethers.
The Pictor moved in, and the shadow of hose lines could be seen through the vapor clouds. Huge, semi-rigid pipes transporting megalitres of fuel to the vessel's cavernous tanks every minute.
We can see it, said Cybus. Can it see us?
No.
How can you be certain?
Do you think I would be getting this close if I wasn't certain? Said Wayland. If that ship knew we were here, it would be blasting its fuel lines clear and the EMAG tethers would already be disengaged.
Tyro rose from his seat and bent over the guardrail.
And the rest of the Alpha Legion ships?
The Sisypheum and the Iron Heart had traced separate spiraling routes to the seventh planet of the Irene system, seeding their wake with passive surveyor drones. The idea had been Wayland's, and was already bearing fruit.
All three emissions from the Mandeville circumference are moving inwards on steady bearings, said Thematica. At least three ships, maybe four. Impossible to be certain.
What is ever certain with the 20th, replied Medjuson. Displacement?
All at least cruisers, with one capital ship.
Designation?
Unknown, but I'm guessing it's the Alpha or Beta.
Are the astropaths hearing anything? Asked Tyro.
They concur with the long-range passives.
Well, how long until they get here? Asked Cybus.
Current estimates put them over Learner 212 no later than 15 hours from now, said Thematica.
Well, then we need to move fast, said Cybus. What do we know of any Alpha Legion presence down there?
Nothing with any certainty, said Wayland.
So you keep saying. Just give me a damn estimate I can work with.
Vessels like that don't normally carry Legion forces as standard, said Wayland. But we have to assume this one does. Given its limited crew spaces, its complement would be perhaps 2 or 3 squads. 30 warriors at most.
Too many to take face to face with certainty, said Tyro.
But we don't need to take them face to face, said Medjuson, his image sharpening as if by the force of his will.
What do you mean?
Said Tyro, not liking the sickly grin on Medjuson's ravaged features.
It's time to play the Alpha Legion at their own game.
Descending through the planet's upper atmospheric layer was easy until the Storm Eagle hit the tropopause. This was one of the roughest descents Tyro had ever known, and he had made more combat drops than most. Heat blooms from the platform below were mixing with the colder air above in roiling storms. Squalling temperature differentials slammed the gunship in all directions. For once, the grav harnesses securing the legionaries were entirely necessary.
Oh, no use in chastising the pilot, I suppose,
grunted Vermana Cybus, as his head slammed into the crossbar of his restraints.
Sebik Valent has picked up some bad habits from Sherokin, but he's still the best pilot we have, said Tyro.
Cybus leaned forwards as much as he was able, hands clasped before him as though in prayer. Tyro knew what was coming next.
You should be leading us, said Cybus.
We went over this, Vermana, replied Tyro. I can't wear the armor convincingly, not with my cybernetic body plan. You need to lead. I will go in with the second wave alongside Medjuson and his warriors.
Cybus glanced down the length of the gunship with distaste.
Well, this isn't the kind of war I was built to fight.
Nor was I. But it is the kind of war we face. We either fight it or get out.
Cybus recoiled as though Tyro had struck him.
The Iron Tenth end wars. We don't leave them unfinished.
Tyro nodded and held out his fist.
Upon the anvil, and by the iron, finished Cybus,
looking down the fuselage and at his own armor.
But I still don't like this.
Tyro let his eyes roam across Cybus's armor and was forced to agree. 14 other warriors of the Iron Hands sat locked into drop harnesses, but instead of black, they wore the salvaged indigo and silver of the 20th Legion.
Using the armor of the enemy, said Cybus,
staring at his armor in disgust and spitting on the deck as though to cleanse his mouth of the idea.
Unpalatable, I agree,
said Freighter Thematica, making his way down the swaying crew compartment and using the arms of his servo harness to stay balanced.
But total surprise is our best chance of capturing the platform intact.
But to have our warriors bear the colours of another legion sits ill with me, said Tyro.
Thematica said,
as it should. But the rigours of war make such demands on those that fight on its ragged edge. At least the extent of your augmentation spares you that burden.
The iron wrought moved on with a rolling gait that matched the lurching motion of the gunship. He reached the rear assault ramp, where Nykona Sharokin crouched like the shadow of a gargoyle. The Raven Guard warrior needed no restraints and no harness, keeping his balance with the poise of a warrior in perfect harmony with his body. Thematica's servo harness unfolded and slotted home into the mechanism at the side of the ramp. No sooner had it done so than a trio of bulbs on the panel changed from red to amber. Sabic Whalen's voice came over the helm vox.
Landing zone approaching. Claws down in 90 seconds.
Tyro, Cybus, and the rest of the Iron Hands lifted their stolen helmets and fitted them to their gorgets. Tyro's vision swam for a brief second as his senses meshed with those of his armor. Targeting reticules, functionality icons, waypoint markers, and objective icons surrounded him as the visor filled with inputs.
One pass, low and slow, said Thematica. Then we land.
The grav harnesses securing the disguised Iron Hands lifted from their locking bolts as the rear ramp descended. Searing black fumes rammed into the gunship with hurricane force.
At least they're not shooting at us,
shouted Thematica over the din, leaning into the tarry clouds. Vortices of particulate-rich air ripped through the compartment.
I'd almost prefer it if they were, replied Tyro,
rising to his feet with the rest of the Iron Hands. Shadrach Medjuson Stormbird followed them, barely visible through the dark umbra of smoke. Without the benefits of Wayland and Thematica's modifications, it was having a rougher time in the turbulence.
60 seconds.
Tyro and his Iron Hands turned to face the open ramp.
I might not be in with the first wave, but I'll damn sure be the first to put boots on the ground,
said Tyro.
Where's Sharokin?
Asked Cybus. Visibility was nil, but Sharokin knifed through the obscuring pall of cindered darkness like a turbo penetrator through bare flesh. With arms tucked in tight to his sides, legs straight, he angled his course as a red-orange fireball bloomed below him. He passed through its outer edges, tasting the promethium-physalene mix. The ground was near, his every sense told him so, even if his armor didn't. Too much metal, too many emissions confusing its machine senses. Another gout of fire reluctantly lit the surfaces of his armor, and the matte black needle carbine strapped across his back. This time he saw its source, a flared tower of chained girders. Its heat washed over him, the anchored base out of sight. He was at terminal velocity now, clouds rushing past him. They thinned, and he saw the colossal floating structure of Lerner 212 below, spreading out in all directions like a melted hive. Stalactites of steel rose from a vaporous gruel of toxins and ash. Refineries and ore silos, pump towers and vent mouths like vast sinkholes. 200 meters. Sharokin saw moving things, lumbering giants he recognized as Mechanicum battle engines retrofitted with engineering claws, fuel pumps and lifter rigs. Battalions of masked servitors and automated machines attended upon them like devotees. Tracked fuel bowsers the size of leviathans traversed vast highways of steel. His hunter's eye quartered the ground, then quartered it again, looking for real targets. 100 meters.
There.
Over by the edge of the platform, where the fog glittered with electrostatic discharge in the repulsor field. Two warriors with transhuman bulk moving along a suspended walkway, Alpha Legion colors. They marched from an outflung fantail platform, upon which rested a battered-looking fire raptor. Caustic rains had taken most of its paintwork, but the Hydra sigil remained inviolate. 50 meters. He rolled in midair, bringing his legs around to angle his descent. This close to solid ground, rogue thermals competed to tear him this way and that. Micro bursts from his jump pack kept him on course. 10 meters. One target looked up. Red eye lenses flared in alarm.
Too late, said Sharokin,
drawing his black-bladed swords with a near-silent whisper.
5 meters.
They separated, but Sharokin wasn't aiming for both of them. Snapshot mass reactives punched the air. None close. His boots smashed down on a helmet that broke apart like glass. He triggered his jump pack again, not enough to get him airborne, just enough to survive the impact. He rammed down through the collapsing body, buckled the decking and rolled. He was up a second later. A bolt shell slashed past him with a flat bang of displacing air. Sharokin slipped, using the shock of his arrival to confound the senses of his target. It was harder now that the legionary was aware of Sharokin, but not impossible. He spun low and reversed the grip on his left-hand sword, stabbing it hard into the flex seal joint at the back of the traitor's knee. Even a legionary had to respect a wound like that. The warrior dropped as his leg gave out. His arm swung around, looking to draw a bead with his bolter, but Sharokin cut it off at the wrist. The weapon and its attached hand flew free of their owner, but still the legionary fought. He reached for his combat blade, but the fight was already over. Sharokin rammed his sword into the base of the legionary's neck, twisting its edge and severing the spine. The warrior fell forwards without a sound. Sharokin retrieved his second blade from the corpse's leg. He checked for any sign an alarm had gone out, a braying siren or a host of weaponized servitors converging on his position. Nothing. Sharokin tipped both bodies over the edge of the walkway, watching them fall long enough to see them convulsing as the repulsor field caught them and ripped them apart. Their remains vanished into the corrosive fog, and Sharokin set off at a run, following his instincts as much as the overlaid schematic on his visor. Lerner 212's control hub was 5 kilometers away. He kept his swords bared. He would kill again before reaching his raven's perch.